The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratowski. On this week's podcast, we're looking at the biggest stories to hit the technology scene over the last fortnight. And there have been some big announcements. From Amazon's Kindle Fire to Google's new startup center in East London to Facebook's Museum of Me. Oh, and not to mention the unveiling of the Apple iPhone, we've got everything you need to know over the next 30 minutes. Joining me in the studio this week is Charles Arthur, technology editor of The Guardian. Welcome, Charles.
Hello.
And also paid contents Robert Andrews. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, thanks.
So, briefly, unfortunately, there's a death in our midst, or a potential death in our midst, and that is the behemoth, the camera photography behemoth, Kodak. Charles, what's the story on this? This could be devastating for camera geeks like me.
Kodak is its shares have slid down, so they're hovering around the dollar mark, and the expectation is that it may have to file for bankruptcy soon. Basically, Kodak's problem has been that the world has shifted. You know, it was great with film. It was great with film cameras. It invented the box brownie, made photography something that was, you know, it sort of did for the camera what, you know, Microsoft did for the PC.
Robert, what was your first Kodak moment, or were you a Polaroid kind of guy?
Shaking like a Polaroid picture. The death of print photography has been predictable, and we've been on that trajectory for a while. But for a moment there, it seemed like print photography had a second life in a certain section of the industry. So you had people like the lomography movement making film photography cool again.
Beautiful.
And
beautiful
yet
stuff.
Now even that movement seems like it might be killed off finally by apps like Instagram, which replicate that old-fashioned film techniques. Which I don't really understand, because I have a Holger camera. It does the original purpose of what apps like Instagram are doing now.
Oh, they're glorious, glorious, glorious technologies. But coming back to this podcast, we've also got details over the next 30 minutes of our series of live podcast recordings happening over the next month. There is a lot to learn, and we have the answers. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Amazon, the erstwhile online bookstore and now purveyor of just about everything, has officially announced their next version of the Kindle ebook reader, the Kindle Fire. The big brother, in size as well as in power to their enormously successful publishing game changer, the Fire runs on Google's Android operating system and now integrates apps like Angry Birds to distract you from your linear reading experiences. Charles, is this an iPad killer? It is effectively a tablet, is it not?
It is a tablet. Is it an iPad killer? No, it's not an iPad killer. It's at the. It defines basically the bottom end of the range in terms of price for the tablet market, and I think that Amazon has cited it very cleverly and very well. And it has the same thing, if you think about it, as the iPad. It has lots of content. So you have the Amazon MP3 store, you have Amazon Books through Kindle, you can order stuff through Amazon through it. You know, it's basically a front end to a store
for digital
and physical things.
It sounds like a bit of a walled garden, doesn't it? It's sort of, hello, welcome to the Amazon portal, where you can only do Amazon.
Yeah, but that's sort of the criticism of the iPad, and that hasn't exactly harmed the iPad sales. And, you know, if you look at the Google tablet field where people say, it's open, it's really great, actually, sales there are not doing so great. And this morning there was a note from Richard Windsor, who's the analyst at Nomura Securities, saying, you know what, all these guys making Google tablets should throw their lot in with Amazon. And they should get in and join Amazon, because that's the only way they're going to thrive.
Well, interestingly, Robert, the Fire runs on a version of Google's Android platform, but neither organization are shouting about it, as you would think that they would want to, given, for example, that Google hasn't yet had a successful tablet, and this could usher in their success.
Yeah, Google's Android project may be coming home to roost shortly. It's an open operating system. Manufacturers like Amazon are free to go and tinker with it, rebuild it into their own image. There are now at least 8 versions of Android out there in China that mobile carriers are tinkering with and releasing for themselves. And Android tablets really haven't sold very well. There was some research out this morning that puts even iPad 1 ahead of all the other Android tablets for consumer purchase sentiment.
So why do you think that they're not shouting about the fire? And indeed, why isn't Amazon shouting about the fact that they've got, you know, something as popular when it comes to handsets, not necessarily the tablet operating system, but, you know, that they've got an operating system that's robust and you know, popular?
Well, I don't think Android per se is a consumer USP as far as Amazon is concerned. As Charles said, it's more about the content proposition. And frankly, where iOS and iPad are really simple to use, like I'm considering purchasing an iPad for my mother, Android hasn't really been able to replicate that. I mean, iOS is kind of a Fisher-Price operating system. It's very simple. But Android on a tablet, it's a little bit more complex. It's frankly a little bit more Windows. It's a little bit more of a computer experience. And it seems that Amazon doesn't necessarily want to offer that.
I love the idea that simplicity is a bad thing in computing.
Not a bad thing. In fact, this is the point. I think that's the good thing. And this may be the reason that Android tablets haven't sold very well.
Mm-hmm. Charles, what is the difference between the traditional Android OS and this one?
The point is that where with Android phones that you buy in the shops in the UK, they go through a Google certification and they then get Google services overlaid on the top. So Google Maps, Google Search, you know, Google Voice, all those sorts of things. So they go through Google servers when you do things with them. The Amazon one and the ones that Robert was talking about in China don't do that. They don't do that certification. So they can use whatever search engine they want. Amazon basically routes everything through its own systems. And so it's using the core code, but it's not putting the Google layer on top. And that's really why Google is not breaching this around the place, because basically it's saying, thanks for doing all the work, guys. Now, bye.
As far as is it an iPad killer, I read an interesting theory the other day that says their iPad and Kindle Fire are actually coming at the same problem strategically from opposite ends, which is that iPad is a high-priced gadget, and Apple sells the content in order to make money on the hardware, but Amazon is offering the Fire probably at a loss. I read a teardown the other day put the gadget cost of $209, is selling it for $199, hoping to make up profit and margin on all this lovely content that Amazon can sell because it's trying to become the Walmart of digital content.
So now we have these two creatures fighting it out in the tablet space. But there's somebody on the sidelines that, I suppose, is retreating. Charles, where does this put the playbook?
The RIM playbook. Well, this comes into play because Quanta, which is the company that manufactured the playbook in China and Taiwan, also has built the Fire. And basically, they use the template for the playbook to make the Fire. Not quite sure what RIM's going to be saying about this, but given that RIM actually went to Quanta and said, listen, we really need a tablet very quickly. Please, would you build one for us? I don't think they're in a strong position. Meanwhile, the playbook is putting a huge strain on RIM's finances. It's recently announced that it's going to be doing $200 money off, in effect, through a voucher and a coupon code. That's going to extend over the next 6 months. There's going to be about 700,000 playbooks, by my estimation, that it's going to have to take. By taking $200 off the price of the playbook, they're basically denying themselves $140 million of revenues on 700,000 playbooks. It's really ugly. But the amount of inventory they've got is equivalent to, I was doing the numbers recently, it's equivalent to 45 days of sales for them. They have half a quarter. They could just stop right now, and they could just selling the stuff that's under the roof now, you know, not need to manufacture anything in the quarter, and you know, they'd be able to go for you know, 5 weeks.
It's easily imaginable that the playbook will become the next HP touchpad, and that RIM will exit the tablet market. As good an idea it might have seemed to offer an enterprise tablet, Apple is actually gobbling up the enterprise tablet market all for itself.
Now, why are people so excited about the Fire, though, Robert? Was this an exercise in kind of taking away the thunder from Apple's announcement about the iPhone 5 just in time for Christmas? Isn't this just a taster for something that's coming next year? Why are people actually focusing on this machine?
I think the new thing is the price point. It's very cheap at $199. No UK price yet because there are no plans to offer it in the UK yet. It's the prospect that the fire could light the fire finally under the tablet market. I read some, as popular as the iPad has been with a certain segment, I've read some new research this morning that says the mass market tablet market won't fire up until the price points hit about £250.
Well, read more on the Kindle Fire at guardian.co.uk/technology. And so, while Amazon released their tablet in the hopes that it will take a little bit of fire away from this week's biggest announcement, it's likely that the news of a larger ebook reader will be overshadowed by the delivery of the iPhone 5 unto the Apple devotees. Now, we're recording just before the press event, so here are the full details from producer Scott Colley's coverage of the announcement.
I'm really pleased to tell you today all about the brand new iPhone 4S.
That's Phil Schiller, Apple's marketing chief, launching the new iPhone 4S, an upgrade to the existing iPhone 4, including hardware updates such as a faster A5 chip, which was shown off with a demo of upcoming game Infinity Blade 2, an upgraded 8-megapixel camera, a new lens and editing features, and 1080p video recording with image stabilization.
Of course it starts with the Retina display. Of course it's glass in the front and back.
The iOS 5 software update was also flagged up with new notifications, a BlackBerry Messenger-style service called iMessage, a GPS-enabled reminder function, tighter Twitter integration, and Apple's new iCloud data service coming under the spotlight, although the cloud music features of iCloud aren't yet available in the UK.
iPhone 4S also comes with iOS 5 with over 200 new features and iCloud. And now we're introducing Siri.
The big selling point of the iPhone 4S, however, is Siri, a voice-activated intelligent assistant, which you can ask questions of and have the answer spoken back to you, while related information is displayed on the screen. See if you can work out which voice is the human and which is the phone in this promo from Apple.
It listens to you, understands you, can answer your questions, it can even accomplish tasks for you.
Move my meeting with Kelly Altec to 12.
Note that you already have a meeting about budgets at 12 p.m. Shall I schedule this anyway?
Move it to 2.
Read me my text.
New message from Tony Rivas. Are you going to the party?
Reply. Yeah, I'll meet you there.
It'll be interesting to see how this works in the UK, as before Apple bought the company that developed the original Siri app last year, searches for cinema times brought back American results, and it didn't handle British queries too well. Siri also needs internet access for it to work, and it won't run on older iPhone models. So what did you, the Tech Weekly listeners, make of it? Andy Livingston said, "Very disappointing. iOS 5's a weak update. The 4S feels like a 0.1 revision." And Mark Wilson tweeted us to say, "Unimpressed. I saw someone write evolutionary, not revolutionary. It needs NFC and 4G going forward. This means twice as many upgrades, stroke extra dollars." But Neil Christie replied with, "What countries except the US have 4G? Not the UK." And Tom Davis tweeted, "The 3GS was the same. Question is, why would they need to do anything else when they're raking it in?" The last word goes to Mystic Dan Hall, who said, "Ooh, on the inside. Nah, on the outside."
Charles, what were the most ridiculous things you heard about the device?
Oh, the most ridiculous one was definitely that in the US it will only be sold by Sprint and that it will only function on WiMAX and LTE. That would be a phone that almost nobody could use. So I think that definitely counts as totally the most bonkers one.
I was kind of hoping, you know, that it would juggle itself or it would make you a cup of tea in the morning. That's kind of the ridiculousness that I was hoping for.
I'm sure there'll be apps that will do those things
I'd
for
like
you.
I'd like to see the Geiger counter app as featured in a recent episode of Spooks on the BBC.
Robert, what might the curveball be that Apple will throw into the mix that is completely unexpected? Is it the Geiger counter app or is it something else?
Not yet. There's the new version of iOS, which mimics some Android features, like a new notification system, finally, and better sharing options to other online media services.
Charles?
voice recognition is going to be a really big function of this, because with iOS 5, which is also going to be released at the same time, there will be a lot more functionality added from Apple's cloud system. It bought a company called Nuance, which is very big on speech recognition, and that is going to be big. Interesting that the invitation had the date, the time, the place, and in the little legend at the bottom, it said, "Let's talk iPhone." I think that's a hint about voice.
From a consumer's point of view, I still see a heck of a lot of 3GSs out there. You know, people looking at an iPhone 4 and saying, "Oh, I haven't bought one of those yet," as if, you know, they intend to buy them yet. Is this going to leapfrog that that market? Is this going to leapfrog the people who are thinking about buying an iPhone 4, Robert?
I think a lot of people were disappointed with the iPhone 4's new body shape. It was flat. It was kind of square. It was kind of bricky and bulky. And I think a lot of people had affection for the more rounded nature, the curved nature of the original 3 and 3GS.
Depends on price points, which we might not find out until the end of the week. And because the operators are still going to have to negotiate with Apple, because they don't know exactly what's coming out yet. Some people might, you know, they might want an iPhone 5, but, you know, given current economic climates, given, you know, I'm not sure many people in Greece will be buying one, let's put it like that. So I think that, you know, certainly people on 3GS, they're coming to the end of their contracts. If they're not already out of them, they're going to want to have some sort of upgrade. And the interesting thing is that a very high proportion of people who change device stick with an iPhone. It's more than any, and the loyalty is very, very high there. So I suspect that we'll see, yes, a big rush of people buying.
Well, you'll have to go to guardian.co.uk/technology for all the reaction and play-by-play, because Tech Weekly is otherwise engaged for the next 4 weeks. Next week, Tech Weekly hosts the first in its Tech City Talk series, our attempt to demand the reality behind the rhetoric from the policymakers who are in charge of our digital futures. It's been almost 18 months since the Digital Economy Act was passed by Parliament, and just shy of a year since David Cameron announced the East London Tech City Initiative. What has the government actually done since for the UK's tech sector? Now, these events will be recorded live in front of a public audience at Imperial College in London. The first one takes place next Monday, the 10th of October at 6:30 p.m. And we welcome the Minister for Schools and Universities, David Willetts, to explain how, in the face of education cuts and plummeting rates of numeracy degrees, the UK will have the skills to be a major player in the future global economy. We'll be looking towards the west coast of America at Silicon Valley and asking what our Stanford solution is. And if you have any questions for the minister or would like to comment on the subject of this debate, get in touch at techweekly@guardian.co.uk or elsewhere in our network. Look at your MP3 screens now for the links, or head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly or facebook.com/techweekly for all the info. And if you can't make it this week, there are three more in the series on subsequent Mondays, including conversations with Eric Pickles and Ed Vasey. We'll be tackling issues like broadband access and net neutrality, enterprise and innovation, and ownership and intellectual property. All the debates will be transformed from one-hour live events into Tech Weekly podcasts available on Tuesdays. And speaking of Tech City, one of the initiative's big wins was announced this week. Google will be setting up a startup center, 7 stories of condensed innovation smack in the center of Shoreditch, aimed at training startups in the East London area. What have they promised?
It's not entirely clear to me. They've promised an association with Tech City Old Street, Silicon Roundabout area. You know, Google has quite strong links with the Conservative Party, the pre-government Conservative Party. It already had that. I'm sure Google wants to ingratiate itself with the current government, which is all guns blazing for Tech City. So whatever its announcement is, I'm sure it'll go down well with the government, but it appears to relate to citing developers rather than business execs in East London. They're interested in citing developers there, creating a developer cluster along with other startups developers, see what they can create together through hackathons and so on. But really, Google isn't talking about moving its business operations out of West London, or Central London, rather. You have to realise that that is a hub of advertising sales, whereas Shoreditch is becoming a hub of creative development activity.
What can Google offer in this startup centre, whatever it may be, to the Shoreditch community?
Lots of resources, basically. You know, Google just has enormous resources in terms of experienced coders, people who have often, you know, been there before, had the same experiences, know how to fix problems. It's a long time since Google was a startup, so I'm not sure quite how effective it can be in really mentoring that way. And it's never been a startup in the UK, which I think is an entirely different climate from the one that Sergey Brin and Larry Page started Google off in.
What is the difference, would you say, in terms of that climate?
Money. It's the difficulty of getting and hanging on to money and the expense of running a business. Compared to being in Silicon Valley, where basically you can knock on the doors of venture capitalists and you can find people who eventually will give you some money, and just the sheer expense, running somewhere in London compared to running somewhere in Silicon Valley, it's quite a big difference.
These questions and more will be answered by the people in charge, from the elected officials with portfolios to the business people with vested interests in this space, at the Tech Weekly Tech City Talks. We hope you can come along. And if you're interested in sponsoring Tech Weekly, then drop us a line. The email address again is techweekly@guardian.co.uk, and we'll get back in touch. Finally, if there was ever any doubt in your mind whether the geeks would inherit the Earth, Facebook's F8 extravaganza a few weeks ago, and of course the subsequent ripples disrupting the known universe, should dispel them completely. The developers' conference was live-streamed on the social network, so 700 to 800 million people could witness the messianic reception that the sub-30-year-old CEO Mark Zuckerberg received from his in-person adoring fans. But that's not news. The real news is what was announced, and what we have since witnessed on the current social network platform of choice for, well, just about everybody. Charles, what were the biggest changes?
There's the announcement of the timeline, which would turn Facebook into, in effect, a sort of a diary. There's the open graph idea, which is to let more applications hook in. And for the US users, there was the connection between Facebook and Spotify, so that if you wanted to use Spotify, then you'd have to sign in through Facebook, which all went a bit awry pretty fast.
Yes, well, speaking of that, Robert, what have the Facebook masses responded? How have they responded?
Well, it's not been a total outcry, but many people, even the more committed oversharers and social networkers, have got the willies about this. So, and it's not just Spotify, but the new frictionless apps system. It's effectively a method of creating, I guess, the ultimate live stream, feeding out your every more granular activity than Facebook was able to do. Feeds out every song you're listening to. It's possible to get a little bit freaked out about that, perhaps, but also wonder whether that's actually necessary. In a sense, that only recreates the Last FM's scrobbling paradigm. For years I've been feeding out every track I listen to, but no offense to Last FM, I love it, but relatively nobody goes to Last FM anymore, whereas Facebook is the ultimate social graph of 800 million people. Whatever happens there kind of counts. And so, I've had people come to me this week saying, how the heck do I turn this off? Why do I want to do this? And, Spotify's beat a hasty retreat and introduced a private listening feature retrospectively. And I think they may have, overestimated together how your users' willingness to share.
This is not the first time that this has happened, though. I mean, the news feed itself, yeah. Robert, created a massive outcry. Not to mention, when Facebook stopped just being an exclusive system for colleges. So are we going to get used to this paradigm in the same way that we got used to the others?
It could well happen. I am prepared to imagine that any outcry there has been might well die down, and this may well be how users share their lives, share the minute parts of their lives. But right now, a week and a half, 2 weeks on, there are a lot of people who are trying desperately to switch it off.
I saw a description a couple of years ago, I can't remember particularly which one it was about, but it said, Mark Zuckerberg is the chef, Facebook is the pot of very warm water, and you are the frog. And basically, he puts you in there and he turns the temperature up, and people tend not to notice. But the fact is that Facebook does it again and again and again. And it's only when it does sort of step changes, like adding on Spotify, that people go, wait a minute, I didn't say I wanted the whole world to know that I was listening to the Smurfs or something. It's that sort of thing that suddenly gets people going, wait a minute, what? I'm sure I used to have some privacy around here. Where did it go?
Well, as you say, this is a step change. These types of things are integrated, without necessarily, a big song and dance. So do we really have a leg to stand on? We signed the EULA. We clicked the accept box, didn't we?
You read and accepted this agreement, right, even though it was 37,000 words long and much of it didn't make sense.
Thank you very much. I certainly did not do that.
Zuckerberg's zeal for this stuff now seems to border on the religious. He is convinced that people will want to share more and more aspects of their lives. And
Does he need to be stopped? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, you know, he says no activity is too big or too small to share. All your stories, all your life. And I just wonder whether, and you know, and the Facebook timeline also stretches back to your birth now. I wonder
cage
whether
this beast now.
I wonder whether we're approaching a point where even the most enthusiastic of sharers wonder whether they do need to be sharing so much.
Well, this is a very consistent agenda of Zuckerberg's throughout his entire experience. And many people have suggested that at some point he will grow up and realize that people do have a variety of identities. And arguably something like Google Plus is trying to sort of re-engineer that by allowing people to at least think that they can have different identities for different people. So perhaps this will be the instigator, Charles, that will move people away from Facebook and into more so-called controllable and private networks?
I think the thing with Zuckerberg is that as long as Facebook is bringing in huge amounts of Wonga, then he's not, you know, even if he does grow up and go, hey, we all have multiple identities, even then he's not going to actually change it. And I think the thing about Google Plus is it's sort of like, you know, Voldemort and the Horcruxes. You know, it splits you into so many different pieces, it's just impossible to reconstitute them.
Yeah. Robert, why have they made these changes? Are they concerned that they're losing their foothold? 800 million people, 700 million people, that's a lot of people, but people could potentially start to move elsewhere. Now that I'm uploading, you know, everything from birth until death, I'm now bought into the system. I'm not going anywhere else.
Well, part of it is just iterating products. So last time they introduced the like button, as Zuckerberg put it in his keynote, last year we introduced the noun, this year we're introducing the verb, as though it's a new 2.0 product.
Oh, who writes this shit? Seriously.
But, you know, I think they'd hit, you know, we've all seen people like a story about an earthquake or a death or something. It doesn't quite sit right. So they're introducing a lot more granular activity now where you can express, you can show people that you're merely reading a story. You don't have to like it. And then the other thing is, they basically hired a couple of quite savvy infographic designers who came in, spent a few months looking at Facebook's design, another Facebook redesign, and have made your personal feed into what is actually quite a beautiful timeline. It looks quite attractive.
Now, it's not just music, which some people have argued the Spotify link was timed nicely with Spotify's attempts to go into the States, to move into that market. But it's also things like news. Charles, what are some of the apps within Facebook now for news?
Well, The Guardian has one. You can read The Guardian on Facebook, and we sell ads around it so that on the page where you're seeing it, the ads are actually sold by The Guardian, so The Guardian gets the benefit through that. The Wall Street Journal has done it. You know, a number of other newspapers have also joined in because the idea is, well, if people won't leave Facebook to come and read the story on our site, then you know, mountains in Mohammed and you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. My sort of general feeling about Facebook, and just listening to what Robert was saying there, is that Zuckerberg very much wants it to become plumbing. He wants it to become, you know, plumbing for the internet, because I think he's aware that you know, empires rise and fall. You know, look at Friends Reunited, look at MySpace, look at Bebo. These are all behind us. Whereas you look at something like Google, which is an essential service for many people, search engines. You know, it's an essential service. Those don't tend to go away. And I think that he's trying to find a way to make Facebook something that doesn't go away in the way that normal social networks, here's my stuff, sort of, you know, sites do.
It's good news for services, for media companies, for the kinds of organization that is now feeding out its users' activities, its readers' activities through into Facebook. So every, as annoying as some people think it is, every time I see that a friend is listening to a song on Spotify or Mog or Ardio or is reading a Guardian story, that constitutes a potential referral for me to go and sign up with that service. And Spotify appears to be a preferred service in that. And in fact, in the week since this tie-up announcement, Spotify's active user count has gone up by over a million to nearly 6 million. So it's working for Spotify. I think it's a good day. It's a good thing for media services who are now living off the back of Facebook.
Well, Facebook's tubes. Will it work? Even if you don't like it, or if you do, let us know on our Tech Weekly Facebook page, facebook.com/techweekly. No irony intended. You can catch up on all these stories and watch the coverage of all the announcements at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks very much to our in-studio podders, Charles Arthur and Robert Andrews. You can see all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, and do join us next week in person at Imperial College in London, if you can, for the first of our Tech Weekly Tech City Talks series, or next Tuesday, when you can download the podcast from the event. I'm Alex Krotowski, and the producer was Scott Cawley. Thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.